Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg, and my good friend Kirk Gray is on the line again. I think you called me earlier this morning, and I roped you into doing some recordings. But you were looking at, setting up an RSS feed, and for some silly reason, you thought I'd know how to do that, but which I did. I hope I helped you get that
Fred,
going.
Fred, you are the web guru as far as I'm concerned and knowing all these applications. I was setting up my Amazon author page, and they have a place for putting in your blog feeds. And of course, you've posted basically mirrored all my posts that I put on my Accelerator Reliability Solutions site on. You put them on NoMTBF. So for those out there who haven't checked it out, I'm not sure how you've tied those to Accendo also, probably.
Yeah,
right?
It's underneath the Accelerated Reliability Solutions. It's you've got your own listing there, which, by the way, you should be writing some more, right? You know, this twice a year schedule's not working.
Always get a big poke for that, even though I have the second largest number of blogs on your site. So
that's changing quickly. I think
who's coming up?
Tim's added a bunch weekly for the last couple of months. The CIRM articles are weekly now, and they've been going for about 3-4 months. Assets. It's a more asset management one.
Well, yeah, that's just under Accendo.
Under Accendo. So I got I think there's there's 8 or 9 series, and there's really 4 weeklies that are pretty regular.
Right. So I will get to that eventually. I just got to have the right stimulus and topic.
Okay. Well, write about it.
writing about
No. Let's do something useful for the reliability community. That's why they go there.
Yeah.
So one of the questions that's come up with one of my clients, and I'm curious how you respond to this, because I'm sure you've heard this question before, is they want to go do a plan, and in part of getting the program manager and the rest of the engineering team to agree to run the halt, they wanted to see the plan. You know, what are you going to do to this thing? So this was a circuit board. It's pretty typical. We know that huge number of failure mechanisms shake out with temperature and vibration and thermal cycling. And so it's while it's not a standard plan, because we did know some of the limitations, the IC had a throttle back at a certain temperature and a few other things that we couldn't isolate and accommodate, but we you know, said, well, in the plan, we're going to acknowledge that those things exist. And so we started with cold and went to hot steps and then thermal cycling and added some vibration and then combined. And it was a fairly, I hesitate to say standard, but it was a fairly generic plan. And then right in front and all throughout it was to be changed during the test, and we're going to adjust it as we go. And so we get in the lab and it's time to go from 40C to 50C or something like that. And we already had a failure at 40, and I said, no, it's time to go back in temperature. Let's reduce it. Right. He goes, well, that's not the plan. He says, well, it's not working. It doesn't help us at all to go to the next temperature. And so the technician was like, yeah, let's find out if it recovers. Let's learn something here. And okay. But he afterwards at the lunch break, he was like, well, what's the purpose of the plan if you don't use it? And he says, well, it's a guide. It's the starting point. Right. And
it's a framework.
Yeah. We're here to learn something. Right. And so he was struggling with that. Mm-hmm. He says, every other test we ever run, we have a plan and we execute the plan. And you're saying this one, you don't do that?
Right. And that is a fundamental shift from a lot of the traditional testing and testing to pass, is that you follow kind of a fairly rigid, formal test plan. And really, the goal is to get it through all the tests without failure. And HALT, of course, is very different. You want to see a failure. You want to see the limits. You want to see operating limits. And, you know, so it's very adaptable based on each step of the HALT test. It's like going through the jungle. You don't know where you're going to go. You have a general guideline of what stresses you're going to use, but you don't know what those stresses are going to produce when you get, especially when you get to places that have never been before, which is usually well outside the design specifications.
Before. Well, you hope so anyway.
You hope you better. Yeah. You got a lot of work to do, before you get to really the HALT test, is you make sure that you, your product does meet its spec and have some margin. So one of the things I emphasize that HALT is a highly adaptable test, and you might call it a highly adaptable limit test.
Mm-hmm. That could be right. See, that's why
another acronym we'll use.
Let's stay away from the accelerated.
I know.
Because I like to call it a discovery process.
It is.
Because it's not a test. It's not.
No.
It's not a pass-fail, and I think people get hung up on that, that it relates to the life of the product, or it relates to how good the product is. And it's like, no, we're just trying to extend what designers do on the bench anyway, right? They explore and check and double-check and push things and twiddle stuff, and they figure out whether it's responding correctly. And we're just putting it in stress so that we can learn something.
And the reality is there is no single test that can give you a lifetime number. And I mean, at a system level, it's just not possible. It hasn't been shown to be capable of proven that. But when you get into a HALT test, sometimes it's fairly straightforward, especially in digital hardware. It'll stop operating at a certain temperature, or like you mentioned before, that there might be a thermal trip, a built-in over temperature protection circuit, like in all CPUs, AMD, Intel, pretty much any of the seen have a thermal shutdown mechanism built in that is very hard to defeat. Now, recently I was involved in another microprocessor that didn't have a shutdown, and it was rated at 125C, I think, and it went to 200C, and still I couldn't get the test engineer to push it to the limit. For some reason, he wanted to preserve it, but I think in the HALT plan,
how expensive was it?
it was a $100 part, I think, or something like that.
Not
it wasn't
bad.
That really that expensive for the application and being a central part of what was going to control the rest of the instrument. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and it was the first thing they had, and it was kind of a commercial off the shelf item that they could easily test before the rest of the design had been built. So, we went ahead and, temperature tested that, but for some reason, he didn't want to find the limit. And he was preserving the part. That was a real problem, where I had written the test plan to say, go to where the part stops operating.
So was this a test primarily on that one IC, or were you looking at an overall board?
No, we were actually just taking the one IC on a test board where it had functionality, and it could be a very simple routine could be run against it to make sure the processor was accurately functioning.
Right.
And so
you didn't learn anything? You went up to 200C and
he ran it up to 200 for 100 hours. And I said, why don't you? I said, he says, doesn't 100 doesn't that 200C at 100 hours mean certain equivalent time at a lower temperature? And that's where I had to explain to him, there's basically four competing mechanisms in semiconductors.
Pick your favorite one.
Pick your favorite one. Do you know what the activation energy for that mechanism is? And maybe you can train. But you're going to have hundreds of samples and lots of time to determine what that life mechanism, the life-ending mechanism, or these, which is going to be the dominant mechanism. Anyway, it was pointless. I said, you found out it operates 200C for 100 hours. What does that tell you? You don't know anything. You know, you don't know that it could have been 225C. I don't know. And you have several samples there, so you could have seen that one operates to 225, one operates only to 205, one operates 190C, you know, and fails.
Well, part
of that would give you a lot of information. That would give you the information you want to have.
Well, the key point, Kirk, is that it's the failure that gives you the information.
Exactly.
Right.
An endpoint, an empirical, observable, and it might be a degradation that you have to define, say, in an analog circuit, mm-hmm. that the light output of an LED gets to so low that you call that a failure. You know,
right.
you can't have a continuous, but that's where the information is, right?
So in this IC, you know, if they actually did run it to failure.
Right.
Right. Then we get the other series of objections. Well, of course it failed. It's over temperature.
Right.
And we've talked about that in the past mm-hmm. and others. But if mm-hmm. until you get a failure, like you said, I got 100 hours at 200 degrees C. So what?
Right.
This was not a test to an accelerated life test in order to estimate its durability over some time using temperature as an accelerant. It was to discover failures.
To discover how much room we had. Well, discover failures, how much margin above the actual in-use condition might be, but also how much room we have to test the rest of the system. This was one component.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that, okay, it runs to 200C and seems to run forever because as long as that test, he didn't stop it because it failed. He stopped it because he had to do something else and didn't want to run it anymore and it wasn't going to fail. So at least said for this part, I don't think that's not going to be the problem in this test. And, you know, the next level of assembly, if we can't run to 200C, we can't really probably blame it on this part. It'll be something else. And maybe that's where we should expect the rest of the circuitry to be able to be capable of, because mm-hmm. we know the most active component, the most complex component, is already capable of running extreme temperatures, although we'd still, as I say, without going to the limit, we still didn't know where. And so
That's right.
It could have 225, and that also allows us in the future, if we ever want to use a screening plan like a high accelerated stress screen, that we have a bunch of margin, a very safe space, mm-hmm. stress space, to be able to induce fatigue and to be able to evaluate you know, different samples. Maybe if there's a second source of components, we might have that one into a test vehicle or into a subsystem and see if, you know, that changes because, of course, sources, different component manufacturers have different margins on their components. So mm-hmm. you never know. But a lot of the HALT discovery approach is when you discover something, you might focus on that for a little bit, and it may take you off the plan for a little bit, but can produce much more valuable information as far as the overall reliability of the product.
Well, that's I think there's two things that one the approach of just this is an exploration is one is if the system's down, right, it really
yes.
doesn't do us any good to continue adding more stress to it because
right.
we're not going to be able to see what it does. We don't have anything active rolling there. And it's similar. I think we've talked about it before is HALT
right.
is on an active piece of equipment.
Right.
It's if you take a circuit board and just toss it into the chamber and have no diagnostics, no power, no nothing.
Right.
Well, you never really know whether it's working or not until it melts.
No, possibilities of there could be exceptions to that, but I agree with you, Fred, especially in digital electronic circuits, and that's, of course, what a vast majority are, is that generally, especially in temperature, that you're going to get a signal integrity issue and a failure of operation because of the timings of the circuits and the components. And it's going to just stop, freeze up, lock, shut down, whatever. But if you cool that motherboard or system down, it'll operate again, and you can do that repeatedly. Now, obviously, the you know, if you followed a traditional halt plan or the stuck to the absolute, you'd say, well, I found the operating limit. Now let's go to the destruct limit in temperature. Well, as you just talked about, and that's a good point, is the fact that the next one will be you melt something. You know, you'll reflow the solder. Well, that's not a relevant halt failure because
Yeah, what I typically do is I say, look, we have, you know, we've got voltage and current, and we've got power and or temperature. We've got all these different stresses that we want to explore. And if we take it down in cold temperature until the thing it has a brittle fracture across the board, well, then let's ease down into beyond the lower temperature. And we typically see failures around -40 and things. And it's timing, and those almost always are recoverable. So let's go see if we see that. All right, good. We saw that. Now let's go high temperature until we nudge into an operating limit.
Right.
And the idea is that for the we got the board in the chamber. We got it all set up when we're running everything. Let's explore each of these stresses until we touch something not right and explore those in detail. But if the plan says step up to 250 degrees C, well, we lose the opportunity to learn about the vibration failures, about the combined failures, about other things that can show up that are closer to the operating limits that we want to explore.
And I've seen halt tests where the guy's got a shroud over the fan that's melted. It didn't have anything to do. It's not a relevant failure in my book. Anything that changes the state of materials and mechanical systems, fans, starts melting them. It's not really
something we're looking for. Yeah, Kirk, I have seen failures where we put it in the chamber. The door was still open. They powered it up, and the battery wire dead shorted to the board and melted a bunch of stuff. And yeah, the insulator failed due to melting, but it should not have got that much current.
No.
So that was a relevant failure for another root cause. But yeah, sometimes if something melts and it's not supposed to, that's a relevant failure. But if you go 100 degrees C above your max conceivable operating condition and you get melting, and that's the first thing you see, well, hallelujah, your design is robust. You know,
if your components all operate up to that point into a point of where there's a change of state and material.
That's right. And your only avenue after that is you know, take the plastic off and put on titanium.
Right.
No, we're not going there.
No, you've reached the fundamental limit of technology for sure. That's as good as you can get with standard materials and methodologies. But once you get to a limit, Fred, that's where once you find that limit, like I say, instead of going up above and destroying it in an irrelevant fashion, it doesn't mean a whole lot. And that would be in a non-operating mode. That's where you can start to add and say, well, gosh, we found this distribution of limits and temperature. I know our halt test plan says let's go to the vibration next. But before we would do that, because vibration will generally eventually fatigue and kill a product by cracking or causing a fatigue damage enough. But instead of that, you might stop and say, let's add another stress to this limit, this temperature limit we found, like frequency margining or bus frequencies. Let's see if we can change that.
If we see something that's say 80 C, I would back down to 50 C and then add that margining, the voltage stuff. I would back up and then sneak back up to the temperature. So if we go back to the same temperature and before we see a failure with the added stress, then it's like, oh, okay, those are separate. I look in different parts of the system for where the failure is now. It starts informing your failure analysis.
Right, exactly. And it helps the guy isolate what the cause is and may help you isolate the component. Mm-hmm. Or you may go in there and do like Allied Telesis, who I wrote the paper about their timing. They may go put a hot or air across a component and try and isolate that a little bit. Mm-hmm. Halt is very dependent on what you discover. And
well, have you ever run a halt test that was actually to the plan all the way through?
No,
me either. I think that's, if I did, I'd probably figure out we did something wrong. you know.
There's always something to explore. You always find something, and if nothing else, you find out a variance in the limits between samples. Hopefully you have at least three, as you know, my recommended minimum. Hopefully you can get up to five or even more. But another thing is halt. The initial halt may give you justification to go get more samples because you have a question about this part or a second source. You know, you've had three samples with one particular component source and another one that has another manufacturer's component in there, and you see a difference in those. That would be certainly justification to go get more samples of the source that you have a question about its variation or margins.
Well, that's, I mean, I think we agree is that the plan is a starting point, a guide or a framework or whatever is the way you phrased it. So, I mean, that works. So let's ask our listeners. It's, I mean, for those that have done HALT and have done this discovery process, as I like to call it, and, you know, did you have a plan and did you stick to it? Or did you use it as a starting point for your exploration, which, as you know now, as both Kirk and I would suggest, that's the way you go about doing it. But more importantly, did you run into obstacles with the rest of your team about the deviations from the plan, or did they get it? And if they got it, then how'd you get there? Let's share some ideas about what works and what doesn't work. So head over to reliability.fm. And you can find the episode there in the show notes, and there's comments field there, and add your thoughts. You know, what works and what doesn't work as you help the rest of your organization get the most out of HALT testing. And although I always think of that as redundant, Kirk, when I say HALT testing, it's HALT, highly accelerated life testing. But my grammar checker isn't catching that for me.
I think it's better that we start shifting it to highly accelerated limit testing. I prefer using that, even though
you had the chance there. You could have changed the title of your book.
Well, no, I still halt and half. I think I explained it in there as highly accelerated life, but that was the name Greg gave it, and I think limit is.
We can change more than the plan. You can change the acronym now. So
yeah, let's change the acronym.
All right. Well, thanks, Kirk. And we'll probably talk again soon on another variant of this question. But this was actually prompted by somebody asking a question to us. So I should make a plug for that. If you have a comment or a thought or a question you'd like us to talk about, you know, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. So well, with that, Kirk, let's go ahead and sign this one off.
Okay. Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.